friends. Thank you so much for joining us for yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
We're also here with, brace yourselves, I've been on this hype train for some time. Most notably in my top 10 of last year, I included a little book called 56 Days by...
Catherine Ryan Howard!
It's you! And we are so extremely hyped to be here with Catherine Ryan Howard. We get offered like a lot of interviews, which we're always very excited about, but I do feel like this one I was especially like hyped about. As Alice knows, I didn't even ask Alice. Sometimes I go to Alice and I'm like, okay, so we've been offered this interview. Like, I'm going to say yes. Is that okay? Whereas this, I was just like, reply instantly, then tell Alice what
I'm
doing.
Yeah, she's like, bitch, get your diary open. Yeah.
We are going to Atlantic Books. So thank you so much.
Does that mean, Alice, you're here against your will? Is that what I don't want to be here. I've never read a word. And I don't even know who you are.
That is not true. Just for the record. Just in case. Yeah. Alice has read a word. More than a word. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we are going to talk about, I hope, all of your books at some point. But we are principally here to talk about 56 Days, which is your current book.
Yeah.
Would you like to describe the plot to us and to our friends at home? We already know the plot, but our friends at home may not.
Yes. So this is literally the first time I'm describing this book. You can tell by how this will just come off like
it's
a rope.
Like off the cuff.
Off the cuff. Kira and Oliver meet in a supermarket queue in Ireland just a few days before the dreaded C word coronavirus comes to Irish shores. Our first lockdown was incredibly like swift and severe, and one of the rules was you couldn't mix with anyone who didn't live in the same house as you, and you had to stay within a 2 kilometer radius of home. So if you were dating someone, you either had to move in with them or not see them for a while. So Kira and Oliver decide, after only knowing each other for 3 weeks, barely that, to move in together to get through lockdown together. She sees it as a way to have this relationship flourish without the scrutiny or questions of family and friends, but he sees it as a way to hide who and what he really is. Dun dun dun!
Juicy!
Like, it's such a skill to be able to summarize a book that has so many twists and turns and secrets.
But
one
you
lot.
See, I usually start with that. I usually start with that little, you know, blurb that might go on the back. I just find that so much easier to get that work out of the way at the beginning. Yeah.
So, Alice and I, we both write books. Alice, you write thrillers. I am always really interested in how authors get books written, because I know we all do it very differently. How do you write? Like, how do you begin? How do you get to the end?
I mean, I think I'm learning all the time. Like, when I started out, if you would ask me that on book like 2 or 3, I would have a very different answer. But I just finished my 6th book, I'm starting my 7th, and I really think now, like, I have this down. Like, I know what I need to do to get a book written. And I'm a master, I'm an amazing procrastinator. So, like, everything I can find out about how I work helps me get rid of that, you know, horrible leaving everything. I always joke that if I were to write a productivity guide, it would be called Don't Start Until It's Already Too Late, because that is my approach to everything. Like, I really need a deadline breathing down my neck and then I'll get going. So I always usually know the end, and I would know like the main beats of the plot and who this is happening to. And I used to, you know, use post-its, but honestly, whatever about the environment, they were also just a procrastination activity. So we lost the post-its, and now we use an Excel spreadsheet. I don't know why, who's the we I'm talking about?
I know,
I'm
me. Who's the team? Okay, so we've just discovered that Catherine has a co-writer. The
yes,
royal
it's me, the writer, and me who wants to really be watching Netflix. Those are two distinct people. So the royal we has a Excel spreadsheet. And I will write like a chapter, and then I will revisit the spreadsheet and fill in more details of the plot. So the plot is kind of evolving as I go through that first draft. My first drafts are terrible. They're so messy, but I see them purely as raw material that I'm going to pull the book out of. And what I really do essentially is I write 3 books for each book. So I do 3 drafts and usually then a little polish, which is like a 3.5 draft at the end. And what happens during those drafts is everything can change. Like, everything is up for grabs. I remember going to a workshop years ago with Monica McInerney, who's an Australian writer who writes kind of family sagas, and she talked about ditching 60,000 words. Ooh. And like, exactly. Right? So Bethany just clutched her stomach and looked like she was going to be sick. That is exactly how I was on that day. I was like, are you mad? If I managed to write 60,000 words, which was probably 59,000 words more than I had written at that point, I would do anything to save them.
Yeah.
Like, there was no way I'd ditch them. But now I totally understand, because I write fast and because I do these three separate drafts, it's actually easy to just say, you know what, I'm going to lose half of that, or, you know, I'm going to start again. And what I feel like happens over those three drafts is that, like, nothing major will change. I won't suddenly be like, actually, this book is about a totally different thing than I thought. The plot will kind of stay the same shape. But what I feel like happens is that the book grows into itself. So everything just gets tighter and clearer, and there's no muddiness.
Everything just makes more sense.
Everything just makes more sense. And, like, you go from this mess of a first draft, which absolutely is muddy. It's like a flipping landslide aftermath, to something very clean and tight and, like, confident, I feel like, at the end of that process. I've left out all the crying and the coffee and the procrastination, but that's in there too.
So what's the goal with your prose when you're going through that? Like, let's go into, like, the three book situation a bit deeper. What do you mean by that, literally? And what's your goal with the prose?
Well, for me, like, I don't really want, I mean, if it happens, it's fine, but I don't really want a reader to stop and think, oh, that was a nice description, or, you know, the rhythm of this dialogue is very realistic or whatever. I don't want them to be aware that they're reading a book. I want the story to be delivered, like, directly from my brain into their brain. And I think of the page and the words on the page as, like, a translucent membrane. Membrane is not the nicest word, but, you know, like, the story should just pass right through it. I don't want any friction. I don't want any obstacles. I don't want, you know, readers to have to, like, one of my pet peeves is when chapter headings in a thriller are time stamped. So you have, like, Tuesday, 1:15 p.m, March 21st. Like, I don't want anything that makes the reader go, am I supposed to know the relevance of this? What was the date on the last chapter?
Yeah,
and flipping back and forth.
Yeah.
I just want no friction throughout the entire book. And so I spend a lot of time polishing the prose down to, like, exactly how I want it. I can't listen to my audiobooks because, of course, the narrator chooses an entirely different rhythm and it gives me hives. So
your own audiobooks
I can't. Yeah. I like to live in a world where they read them exactly as they sit in my head. So I can't have reality interfering with that belief. But I feel like the starting, like, when I start a draft, it's a new, I love a wide computer screen. So I would have one draft on one side and then I'll have my new, clean, you know, anything could happen Word document on the other side, and I will retype everything. And I think the flow you get into doing that is what lets you polish the prose and tighten the prose and tighten the plot and the action as well.
It's like enforced editing. If you're starting again from a blank page, even though you've already done what many people would perceive as, like, the labour of writing the book in the first place, like, that enforced blank page rather than just messing around with what you've already done.
I can't understand this, like, going in, like, precision and fixing. I can do that when I get to, like, draft 3.5, which is my little fix whatever. It's like, you know, when someone's pregnant for 12 months or, you know, you've put Wednesday after Tuesday, you know, like, those little things. I could go in and do that. But even, like, my editor, my first editor, who is now my agent, said that it's fascinating. She does, I don't even know how to do it myself, but on Microsoft Word, where you can compare documents, two versions of the same document, and it will highlight everything that's different. And she's like, there's no point doing that. You know, she's doing it because she can go in and just check what I've changed. She's trying to save herself some work.
Mm.
But everything is changed.
Yeah. So I had to do this little trick.
I think it's called compare, it's like compare
versions
or
edit.
Compare documents.
Okay.
That's a fun game we can all play when we go home. But yeah, so I just think, to me, there's just this clarity of doing it that way. I just can't. I can't be going in and doing the little fixes.
So I have an important question. We just talked about timestamps.
Mm-hmm.
56 days, for our listeners who haven't read it yet, is about 56 days in lockdown.
Yeah.
And then a chunk afterwards. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you do have, not precise timestamps, mm-hmm. but approximate, like what 3 days
ago. Yeah.
You're making your writing process sound very, like, linear.
Mm-hmm.
This book is non-chronological, though.
Yeah.
Were you ever tempted to write it chronologically and then chop it up?
No, because I really can't write in a linear. I have tried, right? I really have tried. Like, Runtime, which is my book that's out in August, and it's set on the set of a horror movie, and the stuff that's happening in the script starts happening on the set, and the entire script is inside the novel. Now, the idea of that book back when I was like finishing 56 days, which was like this, the Excel spreadsheet for 56 days was out of control because, you know, the whole thing is out of order, and I had to be like, okay, so that's after they went to this place, but it's before that, and it was craziness. So I was like, I just want to write something simple where something happens and then something else happens after that, and then something, and like it just continues on in that fashion. And the main story in Runtime does happen that way, but that's why there's a script in it, because that wasn't enough for me. Like, I needed to do some sort of structural hijinks to keep myself entertained while I was writing it. So I don't think I could. The thing is with 56 days is, like, I knew the real story. Like, I knew the linear story in my head. So it was just a case of, like, what's the most dramatic way to tell it? So, yeah, I'd love to be able to just write a straightforward novel, but I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Alas, this is your cross to bear.
Yeah.
You know how to, like, get to your end, like, your linear ending, as we would understand what the ending is.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the, like, process of making sure that everything adds up in the book to get the reader there as well?
Well, I normally know the ending when I begin. Now, it may change on the way there in terms of the little details, but the big ending, the sort of large idea, is always in place before I begin. And then I work backwards from that. And, you know, whenever I'm doing, like, workshops and stuff, I always give the example of this great book I read years ago that I remember nothing about, but suspect was a Karen Slaughter novel. And the opening scene was someone coming upon a hit-and-run accident, and there was an elderly couple already after stopping, and they're all attending to the victim, and the victim dies at their feet. And the novel was about who that person was and why they had been the target of a hit-and-run. And the final scene of that book was the opening replayed, but we came in just a little bit earlier, and we saw the elderly couple run this person over. And it gave me chills because we had been given all the information. We had been shown what had happened, but we didn't realise that's what we were looking at. And I think that's what writing a crime novel or a thriller is really about. It's distracting the reader from the truth without any cheating or trickery. And, you know, it's one of the oldest pieces of writing advice, but it's so true. The ending should feel surprising and inevitable. And, like, if it doesn't feel both those things, you know, you're not, you need to go back and get out your Excel spreadsheet again and
write another draft. That is such good advice. Like that, I think understanding the ending is surprising and inevitable is genuinely good advice.
Because, like, the best books feel like every single piece slots into place very neatly, but you can't see the whole picture until it's done.
And my favourite kind of thriller is where you start reading it and you could not predict the kind of thriller you're going to end up reading at the end. You know, like, you start reading and you just think, I had no idea it was going to turn into this kind of book. And I feel like that was a coffee burp. Sorry, listeners. I feel like the only way... Now, you know, you have people like Harlan Coben. I don't believe him when he says. He just literally makes it up as he... I mean, we're all making it up as we go along, but... You know, the fact that he writes, like, Tell No One, I think, has one of the best, I think that could have been his first standalone, has one of the best twists, like, I've ever come across in that kind of genre. I don't know how you would write that book without knowing the ending, unless you're doing it in layers, whereby the first draft kind of had that, and then the second draft had it a bit more, and the third draft had it a bit more. To me, the way to get that, like, tight confident construction is to start with the end and work your way back.
Figure out what could have motivated someone.
Yeah, and to... like, I'll tell you, I did an interview during the summer with Liz Nugent, who is basically the...
Love her! The Before queen, there was you.
The queen of...
That was my Irish crime hype train, was Liz Nugent, and now we've got you. And now, so we've got both of you, so I'm on two hype trains.
Great, and I love it, it's her buddy. So I was sitting out her back garden during the summer in an exceptionally hot day. We were doing an interview for with a German journalist. But we were talking about our process, and Liz was saying, you know, that she couldn't do what I do, that she doesn't know anything, that writing the draft is like an exploration. It's like a discovery. She's figuring out how the story is going to end as she's writing it. And I was sitting there and I was saying, well, like, I, what I do is, you know, I figure out what's going to happen before I start writing anything. And what I realised is, like, actually, you know, there's this whole debate about, like, are you a plotter, are you a pantser? We're all doing the same thing. We are all doing the same thing. There is all a stage where we have to figure out how the story is going to take place and what it's going to be shaped like and how it's going to end. Liz does that by writing a draft, but I do that by, like, jotting some stuff down on a spreadsheet after I've been for a walk or, you know, procrastinated or whatever. Like... To me, sometimes I think writers who plot in advance get a bit of a sort of, oh, you're not doing it the right way.
Or you're not, like, creative. You're not creative. And inspired,
yes,
and imaginative.
Whereas, yeah, you know, the rest of them are up in a sort of garret writing by charcoal. Like they're the real writers. But we're all doing the same thing. I just don't do it in a draft. I'm not writing a full draft to find out the beats of the story. And I prefer my way because it means that... That's one draft less. Like, I would have to write...
Four books.
To get one book. By the time I'm writing that first draft, I already know the story. I've just skipped ahead a little bit. But we're all doing the same thing. We're all literally making it up as we go along.
And readers can't tell. Because we ask this question every time we do an interview. There are some questions that we always want to know. And one of them is, like, what's your process? And I'm frequently surprised by the answer. Like, people that I imagine would be meticulous plotters.
Like Lucy Foley.
Lucy Foley, who...
By the time this comes out, we will have put out the Lucy Foley episode.
She's not a plotter.
We thought she was going to be, like, an intricate little nerdy plotter.
Yeah.
No, she's freestyling. Yeah. She's out there vibing. But yeah, I'm not a vibes-based writer.
Yeah.
Are you a vibes-based writer, Alice Slater?
I am a vibes-based writer who's trying her best to reform my ways because it's not the easiest way to do it. Like, I think my debut, which is not out until, like, a full year, but I definitely found that I made more work for myself by just...
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm sober behind the wheel, but, like, I don't know where we're going.
Do you think that is also a product of writing, like, a dual point of view thriller? That if you were writing a different kind of book, it might be easier?
I mean, yes, but not necessarily because of plotting. Mm. I think it's more from coming up through short stories where you have a whole view of the whole thing every time you sit down to write. But this isn't about me.
No, I'm just interested.
But I would just say that, like, there is no right way, like, except whatever gets you... to a finished
that's
draft
exactly,
by your deadline.
Yeah.
Like, that's 100%. The best way for you to write a book. So,
there's only the right way for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
Did you know, as just, like, some fun gossip, that in an interview, Sarah Moss said that she writes her full first draft and then throws it away, never looks at it again.
That's fucked up.
Okay, we're not in. That is the wrong way.
we're just going to retract
saying... I take
saying
back what I just said. Don't throw away your drafts. That is craziness.
Yeah. There is one wrong way.
Yeah.
It's that way.
Is she sober when she throws away the mother? I couldn't.
She's high as hell.
I don't even print mine out. I keep everything on the computer in case something would go missing. That's actually giving me, like...
Hives.
Yeah.
Full body chills. Okay, so I don't know if this is a controversial question, but at any point, did you worry about writing a lockdown thriller?
I mean, I'm worried about it right now.
It's out in the world,
it's out
and I'm still worried.
Now, and I'm still worried. Of course, I mean, yes. And, like, I'm friends, speaking of Liz Nugent, I'm friends with a lot of crime writers, and I just definitely got the vibes from them all that, like, I was crazy. And this was, they were like, you know, what are you writing now? And I'm like, well, I'm kind of writing a lockdown thriller. Like, you know, and they'd make a face like, I know, there's no need to say anything to me. And they would look at me, like, in horror. I wrote a piece for
the Irish Times about how, like, the look on their faces anytime I mentioned it, and they'd be like, is this book one or two in the deal? Just like, you know, do you have another book after this? Or, you
know, is this game over?
Is this game over? And luckily I did. It was book one or two. So I knew everyone around me thought I was making a massive mistake. I felt like it could go either way. And my feeling was either I'll be forgiven for this, or I'll be, you know, at the front of something. I'll be the first one with a lockdown novel, and I will show people that a lockdown novel deserves to have a place. Like, it's not even lockdown, you know, as a gimmick or anything. It's just the great setting for this story idea, which couldn't really have existed without this scenario in real life. But, like, I mean, every day I'm seeing on Instagram, you know, because they helpfully tag me. I didn't, you know, I don't want to read that. Like, I don't think I can, you know, read it. And the other thing is, like, I am not going to force anyone to read a novel about lockdown. We all had a completely different experience of the pandemic. People lost loved ones. People lost livelihoods. People have been sick for so long. Like, I'm not going to say get over your aversion to lockdown novels and go buy my book. Like, that's not going to happen. But I do think that the people who were on the fence and then went and read it came away feeling like it wasn't a lockdown novel.
100%. Like, I was very, like, lukewarm about the concept of reading a book about lockdown, especially when we were so close to having experienced it. But I would... There is basically nothing that you could write about that I'd be like, I'm not going to read that.
I'm sure I could think of something.
You try.
Is that just a challenge?
Try. Yeah, just you try. So how did you end up writing this book? What was the... Yeah, when did you write it? Because you must... It came out, like, in hardback not that long after actually...
It came out in August 2021 in hardback. This book came out of, like, despair and necessity, essentially. Like, all books, probably.
All work, really.
all work
of any kind.
So, I was writing a different book. And, like, I knew in my bones it was not great. But I was like, look, there's no other idea. I'm absolutely a one-idea-at-a-time writer. So, if I ditched that book, I was left with nothing. Like, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I had to deliver in a few months' time because I write a book a year. So then the world went on fire and we were in lockdown, and I thought, well, no one's going to give out to me now for, like, all the chat on Twitter was, I can't write, you know, how can I possibly be creative? And I was like, yes, how can I possibly be creative in this in this time, you know? So I didn't worry about writing, and I got to, like, rewatching Lost and developing a Lego obsession and living on a diet almost exclusively of M&S Rosé and Tayshia waffles. I don't know if you have them in this, but they're like bacon flavored crisps in a waffle.
I can envisage it, but I haven't had it. Yummy. So when I go to Cork next month, I will prioritize.
Yes, waffles. Yeah. And I will say they hurt your mouth. It's totally worth it.
I want to feel the pain.
That should be their... I'm going to petition Tayshia's to change their slogan. They'll hurt your mouth, but it's worth it. So then I heard actually your deputy chief medical officer say that new couples... Now, she didn't say break up or shack up, but that would have been a much better phrase to use than whatever she did choose. Yeah, I should have been her, like, communications advisor at the time. But we had an extremely severe lockdown. So if you were dating someone and you wanted to abide by the rules, you couldn't see them if they were living in a different house. And you really couldn't see them if they were living more than 2 kilometres away from you. So for years I had had this, like, it wasn't even an idea. It was like a shape in the mist of a couple who meet and fall in love, but all is not what it seems. And I knew what, you know, wasn't as it seemed. I knew what the truth was, and that would be the reveal at the end. And I knew the book would begin with their meeting, but I had absolutely nothing to go between those two points. And then I heard this. I'm in lockdown. I'm losing my mind in lockdown. I still have to deliver a book in a few months' time. And I thought, that's it. Lockdown is the thing that they will meet just before lockdown. And also, like, I was in Dublin city centre, and I was seeing it in a way that, like, I never had before. And only the people in that 2 kilometres could see the city that way. And I felt like
it almost needed to be recorded, or like it needed to be commented on in some way. And so I was nearly like writing this book in real time. I have a picture of my computer taken on the 17th of April 2020, and my little, you know, Microsoft Word document full of hope is up on screen saying untitled lockdown novel. Like, I started it that soon, but I didn't tell anyone. We're sitting in my publisher's office. I didn't tell them. I said nothing, because at the time, very helpfully, every writer in the world was on Twitter saying, I'm never going to write about lockdown. I don't want to hear about it. I'm never going to read anything about it. You know, don't be getting any ideas, basically, was the theme of Twitter at the time. And there was me, like, at home, trying to ignore it, writing my lockdown novel. And I knew if I came to my publisher and said, by the way, I've started writing a lockdown novel, in their head, that would be a book that wasn't the book I was writing. Yeah. And so I wanted to show them what it would look like. So when I got to about, I think, 20,000 words, we're up to June 2020 now, Ireland is still in lockdown, but coming out of it slowly, I emailed my editor and I said, surprise, I'm writing a lockdown novel. And we're at, like, event horizon, right? Either I have to stop and go back to the book, or I continue with this, but I have to make a decision or I won't make my deadline. And I think they had meetings and they probably exchanged looks and there was all sorts going on, but they came back and said, look, we didn't think we wanted to read a lockdown novel, but we enjoyed this and we want to know what happens next, so keep going. So, but like, at no point up to and including today, the week of the paperback launch, have I felt any confidence writing a lockdown novel. And I also feel really guilty. I really feel guilty that 2020 was great for me. Mm. It was my most successful, like, during 2020 I wrote my most successful book, and all the success was in 2021. So when people talk about the last 2 years, I'm just like silent, like I just don't offer up any.
I think that is, I think, the thing with all of the noise on Twitter about, there were lots of people, readers as well as writers, saying, yeah, like, don't even think about touching lockdown, don't even think about touching coronavirus. And I do understand that people are probably imagining, like, some of the, like, literary lovies of the last 5 years who've rushed out books to try and be the political fiction about whatever, a particular moment or what have you. Whereas, you know, lockdown actually ended up lasting for a really long time.
Yeah.
And, like, writers are going to write. We're going to be inspired by what we're experiencing. And
yeah,
to already have had an idea that was born independently of lockdown, but then lockdown provides this backdrop that makes it possible to take that idea and really run with it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you at least try it? Like, I mean, who are you going to listen to? These people who don't dare try?
Well, like, I never listen to anyone. I don't even listen to the people I should be listening to half the time. But, like, I always say, you know, people ask me, like, would I have written this book under different circumstances? And the way I describe it is, like, in the universe of this novel, Kira and Oliver would have met and this would have happened and I would have written about them, but just not like this. And I think this was the best way, like, for them and for me.
Yeah, so, to set up this, like, accelerated pressure cooker situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I have, like, loads of questions that I want to ask you, okay, all to do with the concept of ideas.
Yeah.
I'm going to begin by asking
Those little bitchy things.
Okay, so my first question regarding ideas is, how did you know that the book that you were writing before you decided to pivot to 56 days, how did you know that wasn't going to work? And also, how do you feel about having to abandon an idea? Are you full of ideas, or are they rare and it's very difficult to wrench yourself away from an idea?
I have no ideas. I was once asked by someone in my American publisher, like, how many ideas are in the bag? And I said, we don't need a bag.
Because
there is
no bag.
We don't even need pockets. I don't even need a hand. So I have one idea at a time. And I think, actually, a lot of it is to do with what I mean when I say idea.
Yeah.
So, like, friends of mine who are also writers will say, I have loads of ideas. And I'll be like, okay, go. Tell me what they are. And it'll be like, well, I think it'd be really interesting to write about, I don't know. No, I can't even come up with examples because I'm so bad at coming up with ideas. Let's just say, I think it'd be interesting to write a book set in a publishing house, or I think it'd be interesting to write a book set in a tech company. And I'm like, those aren't ideas. Like, an idea for me is enough meat for the book to get going, to get started. I think everything before that is like a seed, almost a seed of an idea. So I only have one at a time, and it's the one I'm working on. The book I abandoned was actually inspired, to use a loose term, of something I saw happen in the media in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. And it was a really, it was one of those things where you're sitting at home and you're like, am I the only one making this connection, or can other people see this too? And I'll tell you what it is, because someone needs to write a novel about this and it's not going to be me. The attack of the Bataclan, there was a man who died who worked for the band. I think he was their merchandiser. And the morning after, there was a woman who was like, we're old friends, and he died in my arms, and we reconnected and we spent a night together. And, you know, I think he was the love of my life, and like, the timing was never quite right, whatever. And all so far so standard. But meanwhile, in New York, on Twitter, his girlfriend is desperate for information about what happened. Now, when I saw this, I was like, this is so awkward, and, you know, obviously the woman in New York doesn't know anything about what he was doing in Paris the night before he died. But what's crazy is a year later, the Washington Post did an article called Love in the Time of Terrorism, and they interviewed the woman who was with him in Paris as his partner. Now, to me, I was like, what is going on there? Now, I don't know what's going on there, and honestly, it's not my business. But in terms of like the seed of fiction, so I kind of wanted to write about a public like atrocity,
yeah,
where you're on the other side of the world and your boyfriend or fiance has been caught up in it. And next thing, a woman that you know nothing about is his partner in the media.
Like the way that a public event could expose a private thing that you never even knew existed.
Yeah, and in my mind, of course, one woman is absolutely lying, because I'm a crime writer.
Well, like, I was like, okay, so which one?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it would have to be the one that you didn't think,
yeah,
you know. But I had a conversation with an editor of mine years ago about this book, and I have already said I never listened to anyone, but this is kind of evidence that sometimes I do. She said, that's not a crime novel. Like, where's the crime? Like, unless someone is going to murder, you know, someone, yeah, or whatever. And that always kind of stuck in my mind. And I was like, no, it's going to be, like, I know, I can see it, it's going to be a crime novel. But I think when I sat down to write it, I realised that my fascination with that situation could only go so far, and just wasn't enough meat for the full book. And, like, I don't know what I would have done if the idea for 56 Days didn't come along. I've spent so long answering this question, I forget whether other parts to it.
No, I'm just interested in the... So you have high standards for the thrillers that you read, and clearly also the thrillers that you write.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't have been capable of turning that into a full book, I guess, because you would, in your heart of hearts, known that, like,
yeah,
you couldn't do it. Like,
I couldn't stretch it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to feel like I'm stretching anything. I remember before I wrote Distress Signals, I have friends in Penguin Ireland, and I really thought if I could just write something, the kind of stuff that Penguin Ireland were publishing at the time, they would publish me and we can, you know, all be friends forever. But what they were publishing at the time was like Marion Keyes, Sinead Moriarty, and what we would call, I suppose, women's commercial fiction, even though I know people are upset about that term, but just for the sake of shorthand. And so I tried to write something like that, even though it's not what I read, and I had no, like, love for it in my heart, really, as a genre. And I remember sitting down, and, like, I had some ideas, all of which were in some way connected to evil slimming companies, because I have a lot of personal experience of evil slimming companies, attending them. And,
yeah, relatable.
Paying money for, yeah, them. So I do have a novel in a drawer called Results Not Typical, which is a sort of corporate satire about a slimming company that, like, in my heart I would love to see in the world someday, but it's just too weird. It's just too weird for the masses. But all based on my personal thousands of pounds or whatever that I have wasted on that absolute shit. But I tried to take that sort of slimming idea and put it into a very nice, gentle, you know, women's commercial fiction novel. And I remember sitting down thinking, okay, a chapter has to be 3,000 words. How am I going to get 3,000 words out of the thing that has to happen in this chapter? And then when I started writing Distress Signals, it was like, how can I fit everything that has to happen in this chapter into 3,000 words? Yeah. And it's the difference between those two feelings that's a good idea and a bad idea.
Yeah, that's so true. That is so wise.
Thank you. I'm just
you are
word.
Literally.
You're so wise. Passing out these absolute nugs. Like.
Nugs of wisdom.
Hashtag nugs.
So, okay. So Distress Signals was your first thriller.
Yes.
What motivated that pivot from what you had been trying to write before or whatever you thought you were going to write to get yourself published by Penguin Ireland to be BFFs forever?
Yeah.
What?
They're still, what we're still BFFs.
You're still BFFs.
Yeah.
Yeah, what motivated that? Where did that come from?
So what happened was, like, I have been desperate to be a writer since I found out that, like, you could be a writer and that could be your job. But again, we come back to the absolute wasteland of ideas. Like, I never had an idea that pushed me past those first, like, two or three chapters. And I think a lot of it was psychological. I think I wanted it so badly, and I've often said I never want to want anything in my life again as much as I wanted to get published, because if it didn't happen, God only knows where I would be. I wanted it too much, and actually that's what my next book, which is out in the summer runtime, is kind of about. It's about wanting something too much. But anyway, just getting distracted now by runtime. But basically, I had no ideas. I didn't have any idea that was an idea in the sense that I could write a book. And my mom had this habit of, like, if she was in a cafe or something and someone had left behind a magazine, she'd be like, free magazine. And then she'd read it and she'd, like, bring it to me, because she thinks I'd be interested in some, like, article with the most tenuous link to something I actually was interested in. Luckily, she just sends links now, so you don't have to deal with the recycling. But she came home one day with the Guardian Weekend magazine, I think it was November 2011, and the cover story was Lost at Sea by John Ronson. I used to work for Disney in Orlando, and the cover story was about a British woman who had disappeared from the Disney Wonder. She was a Disney cast member, which is Disney speak for employee. And
Disney Wonder is a cruise ship.
A cruise ship.
Yeah.
And the cover image, I can, like, I still have it at home, but it was this huge vista, like a horizon of sea, and a tiny, like the size of your fingernail, cruise ship. But the cruise ship in reality was massive. And of course, the photo was showing us, like, what it's like to be on a cruise ship in international waters. And I read the article, and what actually stuck with me was this phrase, International Cruise Victims Organization. And I'd never been on a cruise, have not been, will not, never go, ever. The cruise industry love me. But I thought, like, the worst thing, now, as it happens, there was a new worst thing that can happen on a cruise ship. But back then, the worst thing was norovirus, like, that you could get, you know, an upset tummy or something. Or stuck with horrible people, which is the main reason I don't go on cruise ships, because you're stuck with the same group. But I Googled and I found out, like, absolutely horrific things about maritime law, about cruise ship disappearances. I don't know if this is actually a proven statistic, but there was a quote from someone involved in that organisation that said the average sexual crime rate on a cruise ship is 50% higher than that in the average American city.
Jesus, what?
Yes. Now, like, I don't know if, like, that was his quote. I can't verify it. But when I started thinking about what a cruise ship is like, and essentially I thought, and this is a perfectly normal thought for a crime writer to have, I hope, if I were a serial killer, that's where I would hunt. And there was this weird thing that, because of the number of cruise ship disappearances, the FBI, so if something happens to you on a cruise ship, the authority responsible for investigating your disappearance or murder or sexual assault is the authority of the country where the ship is registered.
Yes.
So if something happens to you halfway around the world, you may have to wait for two Bahamian police officers to come to the ship. In the meantime, crime scenes have been cleaned, witnesses have disembarked, you know, the body can go into the water, but that's the way it is. So Americans actually lobbied to have a rule in place whereby no matter where you are and no matter what country is involved, the FBI are responsible for your investigation if it happens on a cruise ship.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, if someone I loved went missing from a cruise ship, I need the FBI to get involved, because they're the only ones who, you know,
give
are going
shit.
To do it, give
yeah.
a shit. So what would I do? How far would I go to get the FBI to the cruise ship? And that's where that idea came from. So I finally had an idea. I still procrastinated a lot. I was stuck on 30,000 words for about a year and a half. But then I just got so annoyed at myself. I did what you should never do, and don't do this. I emailed an agent and I pretended it was finished. And I thought the fear that the agent would come back to me.
And request I'll tell you right manuscript.
Now, it was Juliet Mushins. I'm sorry, Juliet. She was very nice. She was very nice. But I lied and said the book was finished. And she came back and said, I want to read the full. And I said, I'm so sorry. I'm going on holidays and for 3 weeks. And I'd really like to just read it one more time before I send it to you. So I'll send it then. And then I wrote 50,000 words in 3 weeks. And I sent it to her, and spoiler alert, she said no because I'd written it in flipping 2 weeks.
Also, I just feel like Julia is so savvy and canny that she will have read that email being like, I'm going on holiday for 3 weeks, I want to read it one more time. Yeah. And she'll have been like, the bitch has not written the book.
She absolutely knew. And in fairness to her, when I sent the full, she sent like the loveliest email with really helpful like feedback, you know, that then helped me polish it and send it off and actually get an agent. But I think also I had applied to go to college as a mature student. I knew that was happening. Like, I'm talking about now the summer of 2014. College was starting in September 2014. So I knew I wasn't going to have as much time. And I think that was the sort of impetus to finally finish the goddamn draft.
Because you do need, you need the pressure.
I needed the pressure because I was in a lovely bubble where I was like, this thing on my computer might be the greatest thriller ever written. Or it might be the end of every dream I've had since I was a child. And I didn't want to find out which one it was in case it was the bad one.
It was like Schrodinger's thriller.
Yeah.
It's both and neither.
So in my, to my little brain, I perceive The Liar's Girl and The Nothing Man. So I, for the record, I've read all of your thrillers.
Yeah.
So I am the leading authority on your so I perceive The Liar's Girl and The Nothing Man to be like loosely linked, vibes linked, but all of your others, and from what it sounds like your upcoming thriller Runtime, they are all quite different.
Mm.
Do you think they're different, or do you perceive links, similarities, themes? What are you interested in? What are you truffling around for when you're looking for an idea, when you're thinking about what
my delivery payment, that's what I'm...
Yeah.
No, it's all about the work. No, I think like The Liar's Girl and The Nothing Man are connected because they're both about serial killers, and the one I'm about to start work on is also that kind of serial killer vibe, which is hilarious because Ireland is so small, and if you were a serial killer, your mom's neighbor's cousin's best friend would spot you and identify you at the first crime scene, and that would be the end of
tell someone at the pub. Yeah, details.
Like,
yeah.
There is no way you get to be a serial killer in Ireland unless, you know, you are very good at disguises, because everyone knows everyone else and you can't leave the house without being spotted by someone who knows your mother. So those do have a connection in that sense, but I feel like every book is entirely different.
Yeah.
I think Distress Signals and The Liar's Girl, which are my first two, are two very like solid thrillers. They're not doing anything crazy like putting a book in a book or telling a story completely out of order. And they're, you know, I'm really proud of those two books, but they are not where I feel like they're not the same space I'm in now. And really, The Nothing Man, 56 Days and Runtime, which is out in August, I feel like that's me. That's like the CRH cinematic universe. Yeah. Like, you know, that's what I
feel
what
like
I
I've
should...
used that. I genuinely feel like I have used the word CRH cinematic universe.
Well, it's because I like to put little eggs, you know, from like little connections from one book to another. Like in Runtime, a little spoiler, fun fact. It's not a spoiler, but like a little fun fact. It's about actresses or actors. And one of them has been in the TV show of The Liar's Girl, but in the book The Liar's Girl is a true crime show because it really did happen in
that world. That
novel. Yeah.
The Nothing Man is mentioned in 56 Days.
Yes, yeah.
She's connected.
And also Jurassic Park is mentioned in every book and sometimes numerous times. And there's a lot of Jurassic Park in Runtime because I was able to get more. It's my favourite book of all time, so... we'll just skip over that because I don't need to talk about Jurassic Park anymore than I already have. But then Rewind, I feel like, is the bridge between these two sets of books. And, like, I love Rewind. I'm not saying anything bad about it. But I feel like I did not have the courage of my convictions. I feel like I was at a place where I really wanted to start pushing the envelope and move into the space of where I am now, but I kind of nudged it instead and I didn't go the full whack. And I think that book is me sort of exploring what kind of book I could write, and it's missing a sort of like clarity or something to it. It's hard to describe. Like, I love it. I'm not saying anything bad. I will be taking it back and shot by my publishers. But for me, you know, if I'm ranking my books, that's in the bottom slot for me.
The bottom one. So, yeah, I loved Rewind because it's by you, and I'd rather read what you perceive to be your worst book than I would most people's.
Can we just say not favourite? Because
you're not favourite. Yeah,
feels very negative.
Yeah, I would rather read what you perceive to be your unfavourite book than I would to read most people's latest thriller offering. Just because I find your ideas and your motivations, I feel like you have a real understanding of like dark brain psychology, what could motivate people to do stuff, what is a powerful force in people's lives. Mm. Are you into crimes? Do you like...
Not committing them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every
don't,
other
don't
element.
Don't commit them, but very much into crime otherwise. Like, so I would consume a huge amount of true crime, and I always have. There's a bit in The Nothing Man about how, as a child, Eve, who's writing the memoir about that, she's a survivor of The Nothing Man, she talks about getting these terrible made-for-TV movies, made-for-American TV movies on VHS and renting them from her local video store. And that's true, like, that was me. The joke is that at my 10th birthday party, which was a slumber party, we watched Victim of Beauty, the Dawn Smith story.
Ooh!
And just in case you think my parents were completely irresponsible, one of the girls had already seen it.
Okay, good. So, fair game. It was fun.
And it was about, like, it's so funny looking back because it's about this, I think Larry Jean Bell is the killer's name. He kidnapped her sister at gunpoint at the end of her road and killed her, you know, left her in a field. But her older sister was a beauty pageant contestant and he kind of taunted her on the phone and stuff like that. And I genuinely think we were watching it for the pretty dresses from the you know, we didn't understand why there was a girl in a field wrapped in plastic. Like, but, you know... That...
Children are morbid as well, though.
Yeah.
Yes, I Willow know. Freaks. Yeah. I don't think we really understood that we were watching something real. But yeah, the Menendez brothers, Betty Broderick, Diane Downs, all the things that Netflix now are coming back to mine for dramas. Like, I have always been interested in true crime. And, like, one of the good things of the last few years is that true crime seems to be getting a bit of a conscience and is actually coming away from that sensationalized... You know, and I love seeing when Netflix release something new and the victim is not at the forefront or it's done in a very sensationalism way, people react and people give out about it. And I think, you know, that's great for true crime. And as a genre, it's moving into a space where it's a lot more thoughtful and conscientious. So, but yeah, I love crime. Love crime, not committing it, though.
Yeah. And yeah, I think you're right that the ways in which people imbibe true crime, there is a kind of greater sense of, like, social consciousness.
Yeah.
Have you come across that? And because your books do have, some of them have nuggets of true crime in, you know, in their kind of core of them.
Yeah.
Have you come across any readers who have reacted to the true crime elements?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always getting emails saying, you know, is this connected to this? And I think there's kind of a pride sometimes that they've spotted, like, this connection and they know what I was writing about. I'm never writing about the real thing. Like, I have been very open about the fact that the idea for The Nothing Man came to me after I read I'll Be Gone in the Dark. But it came to me because I thought of him reading that book. And, like, I was so sure they were going to find a copy of it in his house. They didn't. But, like, I truly believe he's read it. And I wanted to know, like, I was fascinated by his reaction to this book. That is not only about him, but is also an effort to find
him.
To catch him.
And hold him accountable.
Yeah, and, like, as a crime writer, I'm not trying to, you know, capitalise on tragedy for my own gains. But, like, in terms of ideas and fiction and feeling that, like, burn of, you know, I have to start writing this. Like, I couldn't leave that behind. But he's not the Golden State Killer. And, like, there's certain little things in other books which we can't really go into without spoiling them, that you might think there is a parallel with a true life case, but I think people overestimate how creative criminals and killers are. And I think, you know, if you're reading a book about a serial killer who's a home invader, and you think of the Golden State Killer, like, that's more to do with the fact that they just don't have very many ideas. And a home invader is a certain type of offender who did start out as a peeping Tom and then graduated to taking things and then went into people's houses. That's not unique to the Golden State Killer. That's just what type of offender he is. And they all fit into those kind of patterns. So I would never say, like, something is inspired by, or I hate saying things are inspired by real cases, because I think inspired is like a positive word, and obviously we don't want to do that. But certainly I'm very aware of real cases and real crimes. And I think if you're a crime writer, a good way to, like, stretch your plotting muscles is to honestly come up with solutions for unsolved cases.
Mm,
or, like, yeah, if you're listening to a podcast, like, when I was listening to Serial, the first series, you know, there was a teacher in the high school who was commenting about, like, the students and what they had written and stuff. And I was like, you know, there's an idea there that I could be the teacher. You know, I would take things like that. I would try and, if plotting is something you're trying to get better at, that's something I would do. I would take an unsolved case and solve it, or I would take a real case and pluck someone out who absolutely in reality is innocent, but think of a version of events where they have something to do with it. So, you know, we can't pretend that true crime and crime fiction are entirely
separate.
Yeah, I mean, we can't do that, but I'm certainly very mindful of not, you know, capitalizing on real life tragedy.
Well, we've been chatting for so long, and I feel like we could keep chatting forever. Do you have any more questions you'd like to ask Alice Slater?
No.
I feel like we've covered so much, but I could just keep asking questions. I'm not going to. Is there anything you'd like to say before we depart?
I think I'm good. Just thank you so much for having me. I really feel like I get to hang out with the cool girls today. I'm not cool enough.
You're the cool girl.
You are the cool girls.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So 56 Days is out in paperback now, and then we can get hyped about Runtime, which will be out in hardback in August.
Yeah.
Thank you so, so, so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, ladies. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.